Okay, let's take our Bibles this morning. We'll turn to Exodus chapter 20. I'll be beginning in verse 22. Exodus 20 and verse 22, it says, "And Yahweh said unto Moses, Thus thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, Ye have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall ye make unto you gods of gold. An altar of earth thou shalt make unto me, and thou shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thy oxen. In all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee." In the context of the Bible, focusing on verse 24, where it talks about that God had said, that had provided or had instructed the Israelites to provide an altar for the purpose of sacrifices, in the context of the Bible, when one mentions the word sacrifice, probably more than anything else outside of the sacrifice of Yeshua the Christ on the cross for our sins, the numerous sacrifices of the Mosaic covenant come to mind. The burnt offerings and the whole burnt offerings, the peace offerings, etc., etc., etc. And there were many, many different types of offerings and sacrifices, some that were burnt, some that were killed, some that were from the produce of the land. But there was a tremendous number of different sacrifices, and consequently, again, outside of Christ's sacrifice, those are the sacrifices that one normally thinks of. Yet at the same time, there are other sacrifices that the Bible speaks of as well. For example, in Psalms 50 and verse 23, it says, "He who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me." And I don't think that we would normally think of thanksgiving as being an offering, but in certain situations, it is. I mean, you have to sacrifice to be thankful. It fits in with the previous two messages on 10 biblical responses to persecution. There's times when it's just a sacrifice. You don't want to be thankful. You want to either sulk in your miseries, or you want to get upset and you want to react in the wrong way, in those kind of situations, or sometimes just to be thankful for all things, even when things are good. You know, normally we're so selfish and self-seeking that it's even then an offering or a sacrifice to be thankful. So there's that kind of sacrifice. Also in the next chapter, Psalms 51 and verse 17, it speaks of another type of sacrifice. It says, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise." So a broken spirit, a contrite heart, one that's humble before their God, especially in that particular chapter. It's a psalm of David's confession of his sin. And in that case, it's a sacrifice. Instead of being proudful and arrogant and not wanting to admit one's sin, it's a sacrifice to say, "Lord, I sinned against you. Would you please humbly forgive me?" So there's that type of sacrifice. In addition, the New Testament speaks of another type of sacrifice as well. I'd like to turn to this one or read about this one in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2 of my favorite passages. Of my many, many, many favorite passages in the Bible, but this is certainly two of them. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, it says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. And be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." In verse 1, it speaks of a living sacrifice. Certainly not something we normally think of sacrifices. When we think of sacrifices, we think of something that's presented or that's killed and presented dead. But in this case, it speaks of an entirely different kind of sacrifice, a living sacrifice. And that's more than just a sacrifice, or something I should say different than a sacrifice of life. A sacrifice of life implies a one-time sacrifice, while a living sacrifice is ongoing, perpetual, never-ending. Whereas the sacrifice of your life is the ultimate sacrifice, a living sacrifice is repetitive. It continues every day, day after day after day. It may not be the supreme sacrifice, but it comes in at a close second. It's true that Romans 12 is speaking of that, the sacrifice of Romans 12 is speaking of this, the life of a genuine Christian. There's a lot of people who claim to be Christians, but there's a difference between Christians, some Christians, and true or genuine Christians. Romans 12 speaks of the life of a genuine Christian, one who lives his life as a living sacrifice, of one surrendered to Christ who daily, every single day of their life, dies to themselves, takes up the cross, to live sacrificially, whatever it may mean, for Christ. That's indeed what Romans 12 is talking about. But the term living sacrifice aptly describes something else as well. Anyone want to venture a guess what it may be? Well, Christ was a living sacrifice in the same sense, and of course a life sacrifice as well. But now there's something else that I'm thinking of. Something that term, living sacrifice, aptly describes. How about motherhood? This certainly doesn't illustrate it the best, but kind of gives the idea. There was a school teacher at one time that was teaching her classroom about fractions, and she said, "Johnny, if there were seven in your family, five children and a mother and a father, and you were having pie for dessert, what fraction of the pie would you receive?" And Johnny said, "A sixth." And the teacher kind of looked back at him and says, "Well, Johnny, don't you understand fractions?" To which Johnny replied and said, "Yes, I understand fractions, and I understand mothers. And my mother would say, I don't need any." She'd sacrifice. That's just the way a mother is. And again, that certainly doesn't illustrate it well, but it gets the point across, hopefully. There are certainly mothers to whom the description of living sacrifices could not be applied. Even in the animal world, there are female animals who are, for some unknown reason, that do not have a mothering instinct. And they're the ones that are normally culled from the herd. But whether you're talking about man or animals, such females are a minuscule minority. I've calved a lot of cows out in my day, in my younger years. And matter of fact, I don't know if I can remember, but maybe just one or two of all the cattle that I've calved out that ever had that problem. It's just a minuscule number, whether you're talking about human beings or you're talking about animals. Even with women who have unwanted pregnancies, if they choose to bear that child and not kill it before it's born, something kicks in and they simply can't help themselves and they become living sacrifices for a child they initially didn't even want. 24 hours, this is, I think it was a 24 hours program, isn't that the title of it? What? Excuse me? 48 hours, I knew that sounded wrong. 48 hours. The 48 hours program this last week had a story again. You see it time and again about a mother and daughter reunion. A mother who had given her daughter up for adoption, and the daughter, after 35 years, who had decided to locate her mother. The mother, as the story went, had already had four children. At that time, she was living single. This was 35 years ago, when it was much more tougher on a woman, and she just believed that it would be best for the child, that she couldn't support it, wouldn't be able to feed it, probably would have by the grace of God, but nonetheless, that was what was in her mind, and so she thought it'd be better for the child if she adopted it. And as they interviewed the woman, of course, both the daughter and the woman, before they got back together, and the mother had said how she had never even taken a look at the child. She wouldn't hold the child because she knew that if she did, that her natural instinct would take over and that she wouldn't be able to follow through with what she thought at that time was best. It was just natural. There was that natural tendency to do so. With very few exceptions, the maternal instinct is one of the most powerful automatic impulses on planet Earth. There's very few, if any, any natural instincts that are more powerful than the natural mothering instinct. Being as God intended his societal structure to be patriarchal rather than matriarchal, when one thinks of the Bible, more men, husbands, and fathers come to mind rather than women, wives, and mothers. Yet there are still a good number of mothers, mothers of sacrifice, to be found in God's Holy Writ. One doesn't have to turn very many pages before coming across Jochebed. Who was Jochebed? Anybody know? I bet my children do. Katie knows. Moses' mother. Jochebed was the mother of Moses. And you don't have to turn very many pages. It's the second book of the Pentateuch. And immediately in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis 2, though not named there, and named and we're told her name at a later time, but Jochebed is there found in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, who was first willing to sacrifice her own life for the life of her son. Now that's something that's not usually considered when thinking about Jochebed, but had she been discovered transgressing Pharaoh's command to put her son to death, she would have most likely been executed herself. And she had to have known that. But for the sake of her son, she was even willing to sacrifice her own life for his life. Then, of course, so as not to expose her son, she sacrificed raising him so that he might live in Pharaoh's palace. And it's very possible that it was his mother's own sacrifice that inspired Moses later in life to make his own sacrifice as well. We read about it in Hebrews chapter 11, in verses 23 through 26. It says, "By faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents, because they saw that he was a beautiful child, and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproaches of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward." You know, I have to believe it was either by genetic imprinting or very possibly just as he discovered and found out about his own mother, that it was by her example that he himself was willing to make a great sacrifice. Then there's Hannah. The maternal instinct was so strong in her to be just able to bear a child. She had been barren for who knows how long, but the maternal instinct was so strong in her to just bear a child. She was willing to give up her son from the time of weaning on to the service of God. It's such a wonderful story and moving story. Let's take time to read it. Turn, if you would, to 1 Samuel chapter 1. A little bit lengthy, but again, I think a story worth going over. 1 Samuel chapter 1, and we'll skip around just a little bit, but beginning with verse 1. 1 Samuel 1 and verse 1. "Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jehoram, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuth, the Ephrathite." It's important that we read all that so you know where these people are coming from. Anyway, continuing. Verse 2, "And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children." And then jump down to verse 9. We'll pick it up there and read through verse 22. "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh." They'd gone to Shiloh to worship once a year. They went to Shiloh to worship Yahweh. And so, speaking of it at this point in time, it says, "So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh and after they had drunk. Now Eli the priest sat upon the seat by a post of the temple of Yahweh. And she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto Yahweh and wept sore. And she vowed a vow and said, O Yahweh of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaid and remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto Yahweh all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head." He would be a Nazarite by vow. Now Hannah verse 12, and it came to pass as she continued praying before Yahweh that Eli marked her mouth. Now Hannah, she spoke in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore Eli thought that she had been drunken. And Eli said unto her, How long wilt thou be drunken? Put away thy wine from thee. And Hannah answered and said, No, my lord, I am a woman of sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before Yahweh. Count not thy handmaid for a daughter of Belial, but out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Then Eli answered and said, Go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him. And she said, Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight. So the woman went her way and did eat, and her countenance was no more sad. And they rose up in the morning, glad early, and worshipped before Yahweh, and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Yahweh remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass, when the time was come, about after Hannah had conceived, that she bare a son, and called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of Yahweh. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto Yahweh the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned, and then I will bring him, that he may appear before Yahweh, and there abide forever. Now before continuing, you know how easy it would have been at that point for Hannah to have reneged on her vow. After all, she now had her son. And she could have just said, No way, Lord. You know, especially you think about a mother with a child, a baby in her hands, one that she so desperately loves and has wanted for who knows how many years. And she could have simply said, God, you may have held up your side of it, but forget it. I'm keeping this boy. But we know from the rest of the story that wasn't the type of woman that Hannah was. As difficult of a sacrifice that must have been, she was a noble woman, and she probably also knew that if she did not fulfill her vow unto Yahweh, that she probably would have exposed her son to grave dangers. It would have removed the umbrella of protection over him that she had, or that he had with God. And so the story didn't end there. Verse 24 it says, And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her with three bullocks, and one ephah of flour and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of Yahweh in Shiloh. And the child was young. And they slew a bullock and brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto Yahweh. For this child I prayed, and Yahweh has given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to Yahweh. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent to Yahweh. She followed through with her vow. And it'd be worthwhile, I won't take the time to do it, but for you to read what then transpires in chapter 2, in the first part of chapter 2, the first several verses. One of the most beautiful, wonderful prayers that are recorded in the Bible is the prayer of Hannah and her thankfulness to God, in spite of the fact she just gave her son away, a son she would only see once a year from that point on in her life. And one of the most beautiful prayers of praise and glory to God after giving her son up, sacrificing her son, that's recorded in the Bible. It would be well to read that sometime. But the story isn't over there either. God was certainly good to Hannah. Turn to 1 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 18. It says, But Samuel ministered before Yahweh, being a child, girded with a linen ephod. Moreover, his mother made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife, and said, Yahweh give thee seed of this woman for the loan which is lent to Yahweh. And they went into their own home. And Yahweh visited Hannah, so that she conceived, and bare three sons and two daughters. God is indeed good. It's interesting how so often that's the case with a woman who's barren for some years. And sometimes all it takes is to adopt a child. And then God opens the womb. I don't know why that is, but it's the case in so many times, time after time after time. In this case, God did bless Hannah, for the sacrifice she made. And what a beautiful story of a mother's sacrificial love for both her child and her God. As we continue in the scriptures, There's then the dramatic story of the two harlots with which God revealed the wisdom of Solomon. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3, and beginning with verse 16, it says, "Then came there two women that were harlots unto the king, and stood before him. And the one woman said, O my lord, I and this woman dwell in one house, and I was delivered of a child with her in the house. And it came to pass the third day after that I was delivered, that this woman was delivered also, and we were together there. There was no stranger with us in the house, save we two in the house. And this woman's child died in the night, because she overlaid it. And she arose at midnight, and took my son from beside me, while thine handmaid slept, and laid it in her bosom, and laid the dead child in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to give my child suck, behold, it was dead. But when I had considered it in the morning, behold, it was not my son, which I did bear. And the other woman said, Nay, but the living is my son, and the dead is thy son. And this said, No, but the dead is thy son, and the living is my son. Thus they spoke before the king." You can imagine old Solomon here. He's got two women, both saying the same thing, with absolutely no way to figure that, at least I'm sure initially, thinking there's no way to figure this out. There's no witnesses. There's no one to testify. How in the world do I know which child to which woman this child belongs? Going on, it says in verse 23, "Then said the king, The one saith, This is my son that liveth, and thy son is the dead. And the other saith, Nay, but thy son is the dead, and my son is the living. And the king said, Bring me a sword. And they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, Divide the living child in two, and give half to the one and half to the other. Then spake the woman, whose the living child was, unto the king, for her bowels yearned upon her son. And she said, O my lord, give her the living child, and in no wise slay him. But the other said, Let it be neither mine nor thine, but divide it. Then the king answered and said, Give her the living child, and in no way slay it. She is the mother thereof. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had judged, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to do judgment." What a great example of Solomon's wisdom. You know, it was the very thing that opened the people's eyes to how wise this king, or the wisdom that God had bestowed upon this king. What a great example of Solomon's wisdom. But above and beyond that, what is so often missed in this story, above and beyond that, what a stirring illustration of a mother's love. Even a harlot, a prostitute, demonstrated the depth of a mother's love. Again, willing to sacrifice raising her own child so that the child indeed could live. We also have the self-sacrificing example of the woman of Proverbs 31. Let's turn there and let's look at just a few of her listed attributes. Proverbs 31, and beginning with verse 10, it says, "Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies." Jumping down to verse 15, "She rises also while it is yet night, and giveth meat to her household." She's willing to lose her sleep for her household's sake, and portion to her maidens. Verse 21, "She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet." She's taking care of them. And then verse 27, it says, "She looketh well to the ways of her household, and eateth not the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done virtuously, but thou excellest them all. Favor is deceitful, and beauty is vain, but a woman that feareth Yahweh shall be praised. Give her the fruit of her hands, and let her own words praise her in the gates." She was a woman, again, you know, I knew without even knowing what was in those verses specifically, I knew there had to be things about a mother who sacrificed for her children's sake, her household's sake. And indeed there was. We also have the New Testament example of Eunice and Lois, Timothy's mother and grandmother. And we actually don't know very much about them other than what we're told in 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. One verse. Yet from that one verse, we know that they must have spent a great amount of their time spiritually instructing and passing their faith on to Timothy from what's said there in that one verse. Much the same as is described in the poem called The Legacy. The Legacy by Alice Mason. She could not give her children gold. She gave them faith to have and hold. She could not give them royal birth, a name renowned throughout the earth. But she gave them seeds in a garden spot and shade trees when the sun was hot. She could not give a silver spoon or servants waiting night and noon. She gave them love and a listening ear and told them God was always near. She could not give them ocean trips aboard majestic sailing ships, but she gave them books and a quiet time, adventures found in prose and rhyme. She could not give them worldly things, but what she gave was fit for kings. For with her faith and books and sod, she made each child aware of God. You know, how many untold numbers of mothers over eons of time have done the same? How many times have you heard testimonies by preachers like Timothy, who they credit their mothers and often their grandmothers for hours of prayers on their knees that their child or grandchild would become a preacher, become at least faithful unto God. The last, but certainly not the least, there's the example of Mary, the mother of Yeshua, who stood by and watched her perfect son be unjustly accused, cursed, spit upon, beaten, scourged, and finally crucified before her very eyes. When nearly everyone else had either betrayed or abandoned him, including even God eventually. His mother stood by his side, never left his side to the very end. She not even for a moment waver in her love or did her love falter. You know, until I prepared this message, I didn't think that the love described in 1 Corinthians 13 was fully attainable here on earth. Regrettably, I've never seen it fully achieved between Christian brothers. Rarely, if ever, and probably never, is it realized completely or fully between husbands and wives. Yet it came to me while preparing this message that there is somewhere on the mortal level where the kind of love described in 1 Corinthians 13 is nearly always perfectly fulfilled. It's the description of a mother's love for her child. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians 13 and see if you don't agree with me. First Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 8. I'll be reading it from the New American Standard Version. Verse 4, it says, and as I read this, don't think about anything else. Don't think about love in general. Don't think about any other way that love can be expressed, but think about a mother and think about a mother's love. First Corinthians 13, verse 4, it says, love is patient. Love is kind. Matter of fact, we could probably just take the word mother and insert it there. Mothers are patient. Mothers are kind. Mothers are not jealous. Mothers do not brag. Mothers are not arrogant. Mothers do not act unbecomingly. Mothers do not seek their own and are not provoked. Mothers do not take into a wrong, do not take into account a wrong suffered. Mothers don't rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoice in the truth. Mothers bear all things, believe all things, hope all things, endure all things. And a mother's love never fails. Now let me assure you, that is not a description of a father's love for his children. You know, just take is not provoked. And most fathers are already disqualified. You know, I've got hanging on my office, in my office wall, a poem called Just a Boy. And it talks about just a boy, and there's several stanzas, and it talks about the different things that young boys do. And it always ends each stanza or whatever they're called, each verse or stanza or whatever it is, by saying, don't forget, he's just a boy. Well, you know, I put that on my wall so that I can see it every day to remind me he's just a boy, to remind me not to get provoked, and to remind me that I was just like him. You know, mothers don't have to hang up such poems on their walls. Only fathers do, at least in most cases. 1 Corinthians 13 is not a description, let me assure you, of a father's love. However, what a perfect description of a mother's agape love, of a mother's self-sacrificing, patient, kind, enduring, never-ending love. You know, if you're unable to relate to God's sacrifice, sacrificial love for us, then just take a moment and think about your mother. I'll guarantee you that therein you will find one of the greatest examples of a living sacrifice that can be found on the mortal level, if not the greatest. From the time that you were conceived until the time that your mother dies, your mother is sacrificing for you. It begins with her sacrificing her figure. Now, the next time you look at your mother, don't forget that she was once a young girl with dreams of capturing her prince. A young maiden who was concerned about her complexion, her figure, the same as all young girls are. But narrow hips, firm muscles, etc., etc., were all sacrificed to bring you into this world. I think I've shared this with you before in the Mother's Day message, but it was recorded in a Reader's Digest of a woman who on her 41st birthday was given, among other presents, an extravagantly expensive wrinkle-removing cream. And one of the other ladies that was there asked her, he said, "Well, what'd she give you last year?" And the woman unhesitantly said, "The wrinkles." You know, she begins by sacrificing her very body for the sake of her child. Next, she sacrifices her sleep. First, just over anxiousness over every little sound you made when you actually were asleep. And then from all the other noises you made when you should have been asleep. And then later in life, when she's staying up, worrying, when as a teenager you're not home when you're supposed to be, worrying, fretting over the fact that you may be a teenager somewhere in a ditch as a result of a wreck, or possibly out with the wrong people, or for 1,000 other reasons. Next, her time is sacrificed. My daughter Katie reminded me of this one. I asked her if she could think of anything that I hadn't thought of that mother's sacrifice, and she was quick to come up with this one. But next, her time, a mother's time is sacrificed. Time with her husband. But especially time for herself. You know, I don't know if you've ever noticed it, but mothers are like magnets. There's just something about a mother's legs that attract little arms. You know, and they're always around their feet. They're either running in between their feet, they're tripping over them, they're grabbing them or something. They're always there. You know, I've made it a point, at least, and I haven't done it probably near as often as I should, but there are times that I just say, "Linda, you got the night off. Go to the bedroom, close the door, and just do whatever you want to do. Go to sleep, read a book, do whatever. Just take time off." And I'm probably not as observant. I'm probably like most husbands. And I'm not watching things as closely as I should. But you know, there has not been a time that I can think of when Linda has gone to her room that I haven't later, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 hours later, gone and found her in the room, and one of them, after being told, is still in her room in bed with her. It's just, she just attracts them. It's just always the case. Somebody's got to be with their mother. You know, mothers, they're like I said, they're like magnets. Their legs attract little arms. And then later in life, there's something about their comforting spirit that attracts broken hearts. And so it never ends. It's one fashion or another. Mothers are always like that. Mothering is just not something you take a vacation from. It's a day in and day out commitment. It's like another story I think I've shared with you about the lady who was called by her mother, a young mother of two children, a six-month-old baby and two little boys, one 6 months and one 3 years old, and mother called up, and the lady had had an especially fretful day or difficult day, and her mother asked how she was doing, and she said, "Oh, Mom, I don't know. I sometimes just wish I was the babysitter and the parents were coming home soon." But it just doesn't work that way. Irma Bombeck once wrote, quote, "The easiest part of being a mother is giving birth." As difficult as that is, Irma Bombeck said, "The easiest part of being a mother is giving birth. The hardest part is showing up for it each day." End of quote. Then with the daily grind of mothering, there's the sacrifice of energy. Three little boys were talking at recess about how tough they were, and the first little boy says, "Well, I'm so tough that I wear out a pair of tennis shoes in a week." Second little boy says, "Oh, that's not so tough." He says, "I wear out a pair of blue jeans in one day. The third little boy says, "That's nothing. I wear out my mom in 1 hour." What mother hasn't experienced a dramatic loss of energy? But even with that, a child's daily, hourly needs to be mothered never decline. You know, for some reason, they just don't take time out for you to regain your energy. It just doesn't work. And with that incessant loss of energy, a mother's youthfulness is lost as well. A mother also forfeits her identity as her identity is absorbed into the identity of her children. If she's a career woman with her priorities right, then her career is sacrificed for the sake of her children. Or sometimes when the husband's income is insufficient to sustain the family, she sacrifices even being with her children in order to feed and clothe her family. Nice possessions that could have been hers, had she not chosen to be a mother, are often given up so that the family can subsist, or to just be able to go on a vacation. A mother's recreation is also sacrificed. One mother was describing to her small son the happy times of her girlhood, how she had rode ponies and slid down haystacks and waded in the farm creek, to which the little boy, when she had finished, sighed and said, "Gee, Mom, I sure wish I'd met you earlier." Well, maybe it would be better put this way. The recreation of a single woman or a wife without children is substituted for the busyness of motherhood, i.e. that of a cook, nursemaid, housekeeper, dishwasher, laundress, food buyer, dietitian, hygienist, chauffeur, seamstress, etc., etc., etc. And just think, a mother gets all of that in exchange for some recreation. What a deal. And yet, you know, if you were to ask most mothers, they'd still say it was worth it all. The sacrifices of all of that would still be worth it all just to have a child or to have their children. And if that wasn't enough, a mother from the time of giving birth to her first child to her own death simply sacrifices her life. Because, as the saying goes, once a mother, always a mother. We may have thought that only applied to the CIA. Once a CIA, always CIA. No, but once a mother, always a mother. No matter how old the child becomes, she just can't help herself. She can't help being a mother to even the frustration of many a grown child. But she simply can't stop worrying about her children. She can't stop fretting about every little incident in their lives. Fathers are different. Fathers usually don't worry about anything, or very little, from the time they're born on. They just have a different makeup that doesn't do it. But a mother just can't stop being a mother. She will be a mother from the day that you were born to the day that she dies. And that's something you need to understand. Motherhood isn't true. Romans 12, 1 and 2 may specifically be dealing with a different kind of living sacrifice. But don't ever miss the point that motherhood is indeed a living sacrifice as well. One which I assure you is never fully appreciated even by those to whom her life is sacrificed for. You know, I don't think. I've certainly learned to appreciate my mother much more than I have in the past. But I don't think I fully appreciate, even to this day, the sacrifices she has and is still making for me. I've read this before, but it's so good, I thought I'd read it again for this Mother's Day message. It was found in the Reader's Digest some years ago, entitled, When God Created Mothers. When the good Lord was creating mothers, He was into the sixth day of overtime when an angel appeared and said, "You're doing a lot of fiddling around on this one." And the Lord said, "Have you read the spec on this order? She has to be completely washable, but not plastic, have 180 movable parts, all replaceable, run on black coffee and leftovers, have a lap that disappears when she stands up, a kiss that can cure anything from a broken leg to a broken heart, and six pairs of hands." The angel shook her head slowly and said, "Six pairs of hands? No way. It's not the hands that are causing me problems," said the Lord. "It's the three pairs of eyes that mothers have to have." "That's on the standard model." "That's on the standard model?" asked the angel. The Lord nodded. "One pair that sees through closed doors when she asks, 'What are you kids doing in there?' when she already knows. Another in the back of her head that sees what she shouldn't, but what she has to know. And, of course, the one in front that can look at a child when he goofs up and say, 'I understand and I love you,' without so much as uttering a word." "Lord," said the angel, touching his sleeve gently, "go to bed. Tomorrow is another." "I can't," said the Lord. "I'm so close now. Already I have one who heals herself when she is sick, can feed a family of six on 1 pound of hamburger, and get a 9-year-old to stand under a shower." The angel circled the model of the mother very slowly. "It's too soft," she sighed. "But tough," said the Lord excitedly. "You can't imagine what this mother can do or endure. Can it think?" "Not only think, but it can reason and compromise," said the Creator. Finally, the angel bent over and ran her finger across the cheek. "There's a leak," she pronounced. "It's not a leak," said the Lord. "It's a tear." "What's it for?" "It's for joy, sadness, disappointment, pain, loneliness, and pride." "You're a genius," said the angel. The Lord looked somber and said, "I didn't put it there." What a great testimony to mothers. Thankfully, this day is set aside for us as children, no matter how old we are, to at least attempt to repay or to return a measure of gratitude for what our mothers have sacrificed on our behalf. In Paul's epistle to the Christians in Thessalonica, there's a specific instruction which contains, I believe, a principle that can and should be applied to mothers. In 1 Thessalonians 5 and 12 and verse 13, the New American Standard, we find these words. And you listen again, apply it to mothers in this time as we read it. It says, "But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, and that you esteem them very highly in love." Let it also be so, though not specifically applied to mothers. Let it also be so for our mothers. Would you join with me in honoring and appreciating our mothers for all that they do? First, I want to publicly thank my own mother for being a living sacrifice for me, for putting up with all that she had to put up with in raising me and loving me in spite of it all, for giving her all that I might have life and have it abundantly. Secondly, I want to publicly thank my own wife for being such a marvelous, wonderful, outstanding, spectacular, there aren't accolades enough to describe her, mother to my children, and for also putting up with me. And then thirdly, I want to publicly thank all the rest of the mothers who have been living sacrifices for their children and for putting up with all that the rest of you put them through. May God bless them all this day and in all their days to come. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, Lord, as we come before Your throne, there's always much to be thankful for Your grace and mercy, Your goodness to us, Father, through the sacrifice of Christ. But Father, today we want to be thankful for our mothers. Father, for those living sacrifices who have lived examples before us, oftentimes, Father, ignored or unseen, almost always without appreciation. But Father, we do want to thank You for them this morning. I want to thank You for my mother, all that she went through for me, for my sake, from birth on, and as she continues to love me and continues to care for me. I want to thank You again, especially for my wife, for being the mother of my children. And pray that You'd bless her abundantly for the mother that she is. And let her children rise up and say with me, Father, that though there have been many excellent, righteous, and good women, that she excels them all. And Lord, I thank You for all of the mothers who have sacrificed, been living sacrifices for their children. Bless them this day. Bless them, Father, for all that they've done. Bless them abundantly, Father, and let them be drawn unto You, and let them be fulfilled, Father, as a result. We love You and thank You for all Your goodness, and especially those for that of our mothers. We praise and we glorify You in Yeshua the Christ, our Lord.